All right, listen, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay, we left off in chapter 3. And, you know, for those of you who haven't been here before, just in way of brief background, Solomon had written this book centuries before Christ, and there's a lot of things that he says in it that I think have really raised a lot of questions. They've raised a lot of, just the theological disputes. As a matter of fact, you know, some people have even questioned why this book is even in the canon of Scripture, because some of what he says here on the surface can really seem like it's just contrary to other portions of Scripture. And as a matter of fact, the cults like to use this book, the Jehovah Witnesses and other people, to discount consciousness after death, or, you know, that there would be a hell and so on and so forth. Well, anyway, I have always felt like, hey, Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived. That's what the Bible tells us, that there was none wiser before him and none wiser after him except Jesus, of course. And I just feel like that's why I've just again and again and again have read this book and wrestled with it and read it, because I just know that, hey, there's a lot of wisdom here that you can't see on the surface of it. That you got to dig deep in it and see exactly where he's coming from. But the thing that you always have to look at when you read this book of Ecclesiastes, if you have to look at it from the fact that I think there's, you know, over 30 times in the book, I think it's 37, 38 times, he uses the phrase under the sun. These things that happen under the sun. And what that phrase means, it means the here and now. It means everything that happens in this life, everything that happens in the physical world, all right? He's talking about a horizontal perspective on life. If you only look at life from this perspective, in other words, if you're not taking into account that, hey, there's a God, there's eternity, there's heaven, there's hell, there's judgment, there's life after death, if you just look at life from a perspective of just, hey, the here and now, then obviously you're going to come to a lot of dead ends. All right. Now, he does this, but at the same time, he incorporates the reality of God and the ultimate, you know, destination in terms of our judgment of God. So it's not like he's coming from, let's say, an atheistic, agnostic point of view at all. But you've got to keep that in mind, because when people read this, they get really, either twisted or turned around or whatever, and like I said, sometimes they can really get off on a left field and take off with some heretical ideas and teachings. But anyway, beginning with chapter 3, it says, there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak up, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Now, let's just read on a little bit further here, because I want to tie it in with this whole concept of time, what he's dealing with here. He uses the word time 28 different times in this portion, and I think it has a great deal to say to us in terms of the here and now, because he says in that verse 9, what profit is there to a worker for that which he toils? He says, I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in his time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is a gift from God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. That which has been already and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what has passed. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. Before we can go back to the first verse, I want to just take a look at this verse, and I think it's one of the hardest verses in this particular passage, when he says this, in verse 15, that which has been already and that which will be has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. Now, I think there's a couple interpretations to that, all right, in this respect, that it's almost like history repeats itself time and time and time again. And I think that that's what he's saying here. But I think it could take that a little bit further. And because what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with time. And I've always been fascinated with time. I always have been. I mean, not when I say I always have, since I've been a Christian. As a matter of fact, in one of the books I wrote, I wrote a chapter on titled The Essence of Time, because it always intrigued me. I always wanted to know, what is this phenomena about time? And I came to the conclusion that time, you would think, never had a beginning. And yet, I've come to the conclusion that time itself is a creation of the Almighty. Because after reading the scriptures over and over and over again, you know, you read, I think it's in the book of Isaiah, it says that God dwells in eternity. In other words, he's outside of time. And if you think about it logically, at least to me, I could be wrong, but this is my conclusion, is that time never existed until something came into existence. In other words, you know, time never began until something had a beginning. Stop and think about it. If God's outside of time, he dwells in eternity, you know, time is totally irrelevant, has no significance, and doesn't even exist. But then, if he creates something, I don't care whether it's an angel, a star, a planet, if it's a human, if it's a worm, if it's an atom, I don't care what it is. Once he created his first thing, then time began, because something had a beginning. You see, with us, we're imprisoned in time. And it's so hard for us to try to get out of this box that we're imprisoned in. In other words, to us, everything has a beginning, everything has an end. I mean, I know that even mature Christians, and I've struggled with this myself, but certainly with little kids, because we are imprisoned in time, we always have this mental block that says, well, how did God always exists. In other words, you always have this in the back of your mind. Well, somebody must have created God. Then if somebody created God, who created him that created him? And, you know, keep going back further and further and further, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, because we're always thinking in that same, you know, mindset that everything has a beginning. And yet, you got to look at time from a totally different perspective, that God had no beginning. He dwelt in eternity. Time never existed. Time only began when something had a beginning. All right, I don't want to bore you with this. I'm just saying, stop and think about it, because we're talking about something to me that is very, not just fascinating, it's very, very important. And that is this whole concept of time. All right, what do we do with our time? Because you've heard the old adage, time is money. Well, it's much more than that. Time is life. All right, and what we do with our time, we're going to have to account for someday. Because what does the Bible say in Hebrews 9? It says, it is appointed unto every man to die once. Then what? Then the judgment. All right? It's appointed unto every man to die once. And then judgment. And you know what? I mean, in essence, we are going to be judged on what we did with our time. Because time equals life. All right? And that's what we're going to be judged on. And if you spend 56 hours a week sitting like a couch potato in front of the TV, you know, completely wasting the life, the time that God has given you, you're going to have to account for that. I personally believe that one of the biggest sins on Judgment Day that's going to loom the largest is going to be the sins of omission. Failing to do what we should have been doing, or the good that we could have done when we had the opportunity, when God gave us the opportunity to take advantage of these things. I really believe that. See, we as human beings have this tendency to think, well, I'm a good person because I don't mass murder and I don't rape and I don't rob banks and I don't loot and kill and carry on, so on and so forth. But you stop and think about that whole concept of that person's goodness. What does it amount to? It's a kind of a negative goodness. It's kind of like, well, I'm good because I'm not a mass murderer. I'm good because I don't do all these bad things. But what God wants to know is, what did you do? Because Jesus said, hey, I was sick, I was in prison, I was naked, I was a stranger, you know, I was thirsty. What did you do for me? You see, what are we doing with this time that God has given us? Because we're going to have to count for that. You see? So you just keep that in mind when we go through this, because it says in that verse 1, there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven or under the sun in this life. All right? That's what he's talking about. So we have to look at it and we say, okay, how do I best use my time for the honor and glory of God? Because he says there's a time to give birth and a time to die and a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. All right? There's a time to be born and there's a time to die. I mean, you know, if you go back to Psalm 139:11, you don't have to turn there, but I think a lot of people are familiar with this, where it says, actually begin with verse 13 in Psalm 139. It says, "For thou dost form my inward parts, thou dost weave me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are thy works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was made in secret, and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Thine eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me, as yet there was not one of them." In other words, God has ordained a certain number of days for each and every one of us. All right? He ordained it before we were even born. And how are we using that? Now, I believe this. God ordains a certain number of days, but we can cut those days short. We can cut those days short through anything from suicide to getting out of his will. But the important thing is that we recognize that, hey, we are going to have to account for our life. I mean, the scriptures make that abundantly clear. Jesus said, even every idle word that men shall speak, they shall render account thereof in the day of judgment. All right? I mean, this is what we've got to keep in the back of mind when we read this. Anyway, it says a time for birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. Obviously, he's saying that he's making the statement here that you don't plant in the wintertime, right? I mean, there's a right time to do it. And that applies to everything, even when it comes to planting spiritual seeds. There's a time to plant seeds spiritually. And if you completely ignore the times that's given to you, the opportunities that God gives you, we're going to have to account for that. I've often felt like this. God's not going to, let's say, save everybody in the world through you. He's not going to save it through Billy Graham or any other person. But I do believe this. You know, there's people that he wants to save through you or through me that probably can't be reached by other people. So, I mean, you've got to be in tune to God's will in terms of planning. All right, but there's the right time and the right place for it. And then he says that verse 3, says a time to kill and a time to heal and a time to tear down and a time to build up. Give me an example. When's the time to kill? Because, these pacifists really drive me up a wall, you know, with some of their thinking. But
talking about humans?
Yeah, I'm talking about humans. I'm not talking about animals. Of course, you can apply that to animals.
There's a certain crime and the state should execute judgment.
Right.
Serial killers?
Also, you know, in war, there's a time to kill, but also I feel very strongly there's a time to kill when it comes to self-defense. But the people who are opposed to that, they say, well, you shouldn't kill. And there's no way you should kill anything. And I just say, okay, what if somebody comes into your house and they're about to rape and kill your child or your wife? You know, are you going to do something to stop that? Or you're just going to say, well, gee, I can't kill somebody. I can't raise a finger. I'm going to be such a pacifist that, you know, I'm just going to let this happen. I mean, to me, that's a sin of omission. So, you know, we're living in this kind of world. We're not living in a utopia, all right? And I think that people are living in a fool's paradise that they feel like, hey, there's never a time and never a justification for killing another human being, because I'm telling you, there is. Okay, but you need the wisdom and the discernment to know when and where and how and whatever. All right, but there is a time. There is a time to kill. God said it. I didn't say it. He said it. All right, and he said, "Thou shalt not kill." But he said, "There is a time to kill." So you got to use some exercise some wisdom when it comes to that. Because it says there's a time to kill and a time to heal. Right? There's one of the things that is really instrumental in healing, obviously, is forgiveness. If you are in a situation where you absolutely refuse and say that you can't forgive somebody, well, you're never going to be healed of this cancer that's eating away at your soul. And I think that the healing process you know, has a lot to do with being able to forgive. He says in that verse, that latter part of that verse 3, he says, a time to tear down and a time to build up. You can apply this in a multitude of ways, a time to tear down, a time to build up. I mean, you know, if you go back to, I think, Jeremiah, you know, God said he was raising him up and he was going to tear down kingdoms and build them up and tear down kings and so on and so forth. Well, there is that time where you can say, hey, man, this is obsolete or you're on your way out. And I think this is what's happening to this country, personally. I think that it's being torn down, all right, because we have forsaken God. But when we were with God, it was being built up. Interesting thing, if you go back through history and you see the rise and fall of nations, you will see that very often the average rise of a nation is about just a little over 200 years, and we've already passed that. So, you know, we're on our way down. We can see it because we have forsaken God. You go back to Deuteronomy 28, it says, God says very plainly, if you forsake me, you will be cursed in your homes, you'll be cursed in your streets, you'll be cursed in your country, you'll be cursed in your cities, you'll be cursed in your kneading dough, your livelihood, you'll be cursed everywhere you look. And that's what I'm seeing, everywhere. And then it says here in that verse 4, it says, a time to weep and a time to laugh. You know, there's appropriate time for everything. Look at today. What we're laughing at, what do we find funny today? So often is the very things that we should be weeping over. I mean, if you stop and think about it from a divine perspective, I think to myself, you know, the angels in heaven must weep over what we think is funny. The media, from the entertainment industry, from stand-up comics, you know, they make fun of things that really aren't funny. Well, there's a right time and right place for everything. And today, we've got it all turned around, just like it did in the Old Testament, calling good evil and evil good. Well, they're laughing at what's not funny, and they're weeping over what they should be laughing over, in a sense. Look at, for example, PETA. Have you heard of PETA, the organization? An animal rights organization. This animal rights organization, and they're saying that to kill a chicken, to kill a cow, to kill any living creature for food, you know, it's the same on the same moral equivalence as throwing people in, you know, the gas ovens in Nazi Germany. In other words, they say to slaughter an animal is the same as slaughtering a human being, right? No. In other words, they're weeping and wailing over the killing of animals for our food. And yet, at the same time, they have no qualms whatsoever about killing an unborn child. You see what I'm saying? This is what Solomon was saying. There's a time to weep. They're weeping over what? Over the fact that we slice up a cow and have it for dinner. They're weeping over that, and yet they're not weeping over, you know, the complete slaughter of unborn children. I mean, look at how things have been so twisted in this country. All right? So then he says also there's a time to mourn and a time to dance. I mean, that's self-explanatory, but we're mourning over the wrong things and we're dancing over the wrong things or dancing at the wrong time. You know, there's a time to mourn. And Jesus himself says in one of the Beatitudes, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. But like I said, when you're in a situation when everything has been turned on its head, you know, the old saying, okay, to an upside-down man, a right-side-up man looks upside down. And this is what's happening in this country. You know, everything's been turned on its head. And we're going to come to judgment for this because we are not coming into line with what is the appropriate time in terms of how we act in these different situations. He says in verse 5, he says, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones and a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. This is pretty self-explanatory in many respects. A time to throw stones. Okay, you could apply that to the Old Testament. It was a time to execute people. All right. And then it says here, there's a time to gather stones. There's a time to, okay, make preparation for the future. There's a time to give up stuff and there's a time to prepare for stuff. There's a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. You know, that's pretty self-explanatory, but even that has been completely perverted. I mean, like I said, I mean, you could just turn on this TV or you can go to a lot of movies and certainly look on the internet. You can see people, you know, in all kinds of acts of sexual immorality. This isn't a time to embrace, you know what I'm saying? This is a total distortion of the time that God has given us. He says here in that verse 6, he says, and a time to search and a time to give up as lost, and a time to keep and a time to throw away. You know, a time to search, you know what the Bible says, something about, to the effect that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. All right. The Bible says, hey, today is a day of salvation. All right. Now is the acceptable time. Now is the time to search. Because there's going to come a time when it's going to be too late. You're going to have to give it up as lost. I mean, and what are people, you know, searching for? They're searching for fulfillment in all the wrong places. He says, in a time to search and a time to give up as lost and a time to keep and a time to throw away. You know, I mean, I'd like to make an application about cleaning out Rachel's room. I don't want to read this. A time to keep and a time to throw away. I mean, there's, you know, some people are just absolute pack rats and you can't, they don't part with anything. But, I'll, you know, like I said, I mean, there's all kinds of applications you can make for this. And then he says, in verse 7, it says, a time to tear apart, a time to sew together, a time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to tear apart. I mean, there's certain things that have outlived their usefulness, okay? What does Paul tell us in Corinthians? He tells us 1 Corinthians 13:11. He said, when I was a child, I used to speak as a child, think as a child, and reason as a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. All right, stop and think about it for a minute. I mean, what he's talking about, he's making a spiritual application there, saying when I was a child, you know, I used to reason and think and act like a child. Well, now, as a man, things are going to be changed. I've said this before. It's like if you look at a child, and we all can find a great deal of enjoyment about how a little child will act and how we will speak and how we will reason. We find a great deal of a pleasure in that. I mean, just simply because they're a little kid and they're acting like a little kid and they're thinking like a little kid. And you find it very often amusing and it's very cute and so on and so forth. But then when a person is acting like a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, when they're 20 and 30 and 40, you know, it's no longer funny. It's no longer cute. Well, this is what happens to a lot of people spiritually. They don't grow. All right? Their whole spiritual walk has been retarded. When they've been a Christian for 30 years or so and they are acting like they have no maturity, well, it's because they haven't been using that time rightly. So, you know, you can make all the kinds of applications here. I mean, there's a hundred different applications, hundreds of them that you can apply to these different things. And he says here, a time to be silent and a time to speak. You know, that takes a lot of wisdom. It really does. I mean, I wish I could say that as a Christian, I've always spoke at the right time and I've always kept my mouth shut at the right time. All right? That's a tough thing to do, isn't it? It really is. You know why? Because we go back to the book of James. He says, hey, the tongue is the very world of iniquity. He says, it's set on fire by hell itself. He says, nobody can tame the tongue. But we can control the tongue with the Spirit of God, all right? And when you stop and think about it, I've said this before, but it's just a fact. The average man speaks something like 12,500 words a day. The average woman speaks about 25,000 words a day, twice as much as a man. Jesus said that, hey, every idle word that men shall speak, they shall render an account thereof in the day of judgment. And when you read a verse like this, there's a time to be silent and there's a time to speak up. And a lot of times you really do need a great deal of wisdom. I know I've seen people just speaking up at the wrong time and being silent at the wrong time. You wish they'd speak up when they don't speak up. You wish they'd say shut up when they speak up. I mean, that takes wisdom, right? Well, as we're talking, there's a right and time to do that. Well, we're going to have to account for that, how we exercise the discernment when it comes to our words. Verse 8, it says, a time for love and a time for hate. You know, we all know there's a time for love, obviously, right, in many, many different situations. But give me an example of a time to hate.
Hating sin.
Yeah, hating sin. You know, in the Psalms, it talks about how, you know, the psalmist said that he is to hate God's enemies. Well, stop and think about it for a minute. You know, we're not to hate anybody, even people who are opposed to God. But, you know, who's God's arch-enemy?
Satan.
I mean, we would really have a contempt for him, a hatred for him, an enmity towards him and everything he stands for. That's the time to hate. All right? Right now, we really as a nation need to hate evil. We need to hate it. But we got everything turned on its head. We love evil, you know, and we hate what is good. This is where we're at today. And, you know, one of the reasons, main reasons why evil has made such tremendous inroads in our nation today and in the world, basically, but there's an old saying. The only thing needed for evil to triumph is what?
For good men to do nothing.
That's exactly it. For good men to do nothing. So if you don't hate evil, all right, then believe me, it's going to triumph. Because if you don't hate evil, you're going to do nothing about it, and then it's going to triumph. So what it says here, there's a time to love and a time to hate. Don't let it go over your head, because I think there's a real powerful spiritual message there. And a time for war and a time for peace. You know, I'd like to quote this to a lot of these so-called pacifists and a lot of these war protesters who are forever ranting on and on and on about no war is justified or we shouldn't go to war, so on and so forth. You can always say, well, you know, what about World War II? What about dealing with Nazi Germany? What about dealing with Adolf Hitler killing, 6 million Jews in a gas chamber and millions of other people? You don't think that that's a time to go to war? I mean, let's face it. What's happening to a lot of these people is they are appeasers. And you can't appease evil, because if you try to appease evil, it will continue to grow and to flourish and to multiply exponentially if you don't confront it and deal with it. So there is a time for war. There is a time for peace. That's what God says. I didn't say that. God says there's a time to kill. There's a time to heal. And again, we're going to have to count to him on how we used our time and how we dealt with these circumstances under the sun. And he says here in that verse at 9, now he gets into a different perspective here, but he said, what profit is there to the worker for that which he toils? So he's looking at life in this perspective, looking at what profit is there to continue to go to work day in and day out. I mean, that's what I wonder for myself many times. I drag myself out of bed 4:30 every morning, get in the car, go to work. You know, it's just the same old grind, the same old drudgery. It's mundane, it's monotonous, it's wearisome. You know, and I realize, hey, we're under a curse, because that's what the Bible says. Because if Adam sinned against God, he says, you know, in a sweat of thy brow, thou shalt earn thy bread or eat thy bread. Well, this is part of the curse. But so Solomon's looking at it and says, what profit is there? Because it's like you have to keep doing this over and over and over again. And what's the point? Well, there is no point if it's just under the sun. There is no point. And I've said this time and time again. And when wrestling with the words of Solomon, you know, I've come to that same conclusion in many respects, that, hey, if there's no God, if everything is just the here and now, if everything is just under the sun, then there is no point to all our toil. There really isn't. It's all, to me, a bitter joke. We're going nowhere fast, all right, unless there's a purpose to it. And then he says in verse 10, he says, I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in his time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Here's a couple other interesting things I think he has to say here. In other words, he's looking at the task that God has given us to do in which to occupy himself. And that task basically is to work, to make a living, to eke out a living. All right? But there's something far more than that, obviously. And he says in that verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in his time, which we were just reading about when we read those 28 opposites in those 14 verses, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. He's put eternity into our hearts. You know what that means? If you stop and think about it, there's something within us that really desires to live on and on, not to die. All right? There's something there. God has put it in our hearts, because let's face it, he made us to live forever. He said to Adam and Eve, you know, that they would basically live forever. But if they disobeyed him, he said, the day that you eat of this fruit, the day that you disobey me, you shall surely die. Now, they didn't die the instant they ate the fruit. Adam lived to be over 900 years old. But eventually he did die. But God has put it in our hearts. I mean, stop and think about it. I've said this many, many times. One of the most amazing things to me is, just a few decades ago, none of us ever existed. You did not exist. Now think about it for a minute. How old are you? 19, 20, 30, 40. Well, we're getting way up here. Anyway, however old you are, stop and think about it for a minute. You will never, ever, ever cease to exist. Ever. Is that a mind-boggling thought or not? In other words, you are going to be conscious forever. And at one point in time, not too long ago, you never existed. But now you will never have an end. I don't care whether it's in heaven or whether it's in hell, you will never lose consciousness. Sure, your body can die and be thrown 6 feet under and shovel dirt on your face and call the rest of your family, go home and eat potato salad, but you're still around, man. Believe me, That is a heavy thought. You know, we don't want to deal with it, but it's true, right? So when you're looking at this, he says, he has made everything appropriate in his time. He has also set eternity in their hearts, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning to end, even to the end. I know there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is a gift from God. Now, this is he says this six different times in the same way, or six different ways, basically. And what he's saying is this. Looking at life from this perspective, he's saying, you know what? There's nothing better for a man to do than to do good in his life and to enjoy his food and to enjoy his work. Now, you would think that this guy, who's the wisest man that ever lived, you'd think he would come up with something more profound than that. And yet, I've wrestled with it, and I studied it, and I looked at it from every angle, and I said, you know, doggone it, the guy's right. All right? In other words, stop and enjoy the present. I mean, I've said this many, many times. Gail is my witness, and I've said it for, you know, as long as I've known her. Seize the moment. Seize the moment. Don't live in the future in terms of, oh man, I got to keep, you know, piling up money and for this and that and the other thing. I got to keep doing this. And don't live in the past in terms of, oh man, I got this regret and that regret and I wish I didn't do that. Wish I didn't. In other words, you got the here and now, and I would say enjoy it to the fullest right now. Now, granted, we all have our problems. We all got troubles. We all got difficulties. Everything. But what can you do now to seize the moment, to enjoy the moment? And even when it comes to your work, I got a job that's really mundane. It's really boring. It's really monotonous. It's not fulfilling to me. But I thank God every day for my job. I do. I swear to you, I do. Because I realize, hey, I'm very fortunate. I try to look at the positive aspect of my job. I think, you know what? I've been doing my job for over 38 years. And I'm thankful to God that I have a job. You know, I'm never going to get rich, but at least it helps me to, you know, make ends meet or, you know, provide for my family. And with the medical and the dental and, the, you know, everything else, I mean, I'm pretty darn fortunate. In all things being equal, I'm extremely rich compared to most people in the world. Sometimes people, I think, when their life becomes their job, it can really become a burdensome stone to them. You know, they've got to almost step outside and say, okay, look at the positive things about my job rather than constantly. There's always plenty of negative things, but if you look at the positive things, as Paul says, I've learned the secret of being content. If you can say to God, okay, if this is where you want me, I'm content. But you can always come to God and say, you know, ask God for a promotion, a career change, or whatever. I'm not saying you have to be stuck in the same old rut or even a job that you hate. But you have to look at your job as far as the positive things about it and be thankful to God for these things. Because I think when you look at your job from that perspective and can thank God, say, you know, Lord, this job is such a grind, but I really appreciate it. I really thank you for it. I really thank you for giving me the health to be able to do my job. I really thank you for all these things. Hey, now you're in a position, I think, to ask God for a career move if you wanted one, or a promotion if you desire one, or whatever. But appreciate what you've got, because if you don't appreciate what you've got, I guarantee you, you know, you're never going to appreciate what you get in the future. You see, so when you're looking at it, you got to look at life from this perspective. And then he says, enjoy your food. He says that, verse 13, moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all of his labor, it is a gift from God. Now he says this time again, that he came to the conclusion there's nothing better for a man to do than to enjoy his food and his drink and his work. And in the latter chapters, he says, and the wife that God has given you. You know, we have that tendency to always say that the grass is greener on the other side. We have this tendency to always be chasing after the proverbial carrot, you know, just thinking if I could just get this thing, I'd be happy and just get this. You know what I'm saying? Well, it's all an illusion in many respects, right? So, in other words, you got to get focused on the here and now, say, okay, what do I have in the here and now that I can enjoy rather than being overwhelmed with the feelings of what I don't have? All right? Now, you know, I'm not saying to be intellectually dishonest. I'm just simply saying to approach it from a different perspective, because that's what Solomon is doing here. He's looking at all the negative and then coming up with what he says is the best thing to do in life. And it's a very, very simple thing. I mean, how simple do you get? Then enjoy your food, enjoy your drink, enjoy your labor, and your wife. I mean, you know, that's pretty basic. But hey, that's where it's at. It's kind of like, If we can get off of that treadmill thinking, oh, man, if I just win the lotto, if I just become independently wealthy, if I just have this and I just have that, because Christ referred to that as the deceitfulness of riches. It's a deceit, right? And, you know, many people who have won the lotto have found that they didn't improve their lives. It made them more miserable. Some of the wealthiest, greatest men, most powerful men have ended up committing suicide, have ended up, in prison, and, you know, those type of things because they were pursuing the wrong things in life. Then he says here in that verse, read verse 13. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all of his labor, it is a gift from God. It says, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. And, you know, that's a mouthful to me. It says, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add. In other words, there's nothing that we can do to change what God has done, what he has set forth. You know what I'm saying? It can get really heavy when you stop and think about it. In other words, in a physical realm, all right, God has put some immutable laws that can't be changed, like gravity. They can't be changed, all right? You jump off this roof, I guarantee you, you're going to splatter on a sidewalk. I mean, that's it, right? Because that can't be changed. You can't alter that. Same thing in God's spiritual laws. What are we told in the New Testament? God is not, don't be not deceived, God is not mocked. A man will reap exactly what he sows. That can't be changed, all right? You just can't go out and sow to the wind and expect to reap an abundant harvest of blessings. You know, you're going to reap the whirlwind. That's all there is to it. You can't live your life in a type of recklessness where you just completely trample under feet God's laws and not suffer the consequences of that. It's just going to happen. You can't change things. That's the way God has ordained things. He said he did it in such a way that men should fear him. Because there's built-in consequences for everything, good or bad. And you can't change the consequences. All right? So what we really do need to do is go along with God's program, because if we sow the right seed, continue to sow the right thing, see, it may take years, it may take months, it may take a long time. Eventually, we'll begin to reap what we sow. And like I said, same thing. How many guys are in prison today? Because they sowed the wrong seed. All right? And that's what I'm talking about. When you look at God's, the way that he ordained things, you can't change it. You can't. And so that's the way God has worked. That's why he says he's worked in such a way that we are needed to fear him. Hang in there, guys. We're winding this down right now. He says here, in that verse 15, that which has been already and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what is past. Like I said, this is one of the most difficult passages to unravel, but I do think it has something to do with the fact that, okay, if you look at history, how it keeps repeating itself, this is what I think it's referring to, that things keep happening, you know, well, you could take anything, but take the October Revolution in 1917, where the Bolsheviks or the communists took over, and they were going to usher in a whole new social order, right? This is what they were going to do. They were going to build a workers' paradise apart from God. They were going to make this world a utopia, right? Well, the communists are responsible for over 100 million deaths. They've imprisoned millions upon millions upon millions of people. They've tortured, they've persecuted, they hounded, they harassed, they have just been the biggest curse on this planet. All right? And it has showed the whole system to be bankrupt. But even though it can collapse on its face, you see that eventually there'll be a new generation that comes along and they'll say, hey, you know, we need to change things. We need to, you know, these social engineers will decide that they're going to do something all over again. And what they do is they just repeat the past. All right. And that's, you know, it can apply that in other ways too. But I'm just simply saying, I see history continually repeating itself. All right. But it's all going to be brought into judgment. Then he says here in that verse, verse 16, furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in a place of justice there is wickedness, and in a place of righteousness there is wickedness. And I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous and the wicked man, for the time of every matter and for every deed is there. Now, you know what? I mean, he's just observing something here. And he's saying, in a place of justice, there is wickedness. We see this. I mean, I see this. I look at our Supreme Court justices, some of the decisions they've made, especially with Roe versus Wade. They ushered in the murder of tens of millions of children who are unborn. I mean, right now we're standing about 47, 48 million kids who have been murdered since 1973. I mean, you would think that in place of justice, you wouldn't see this wickedness. But look at the wickedness all around us. And the thing that always intrigued me is that the highest concentration of wickedness, and we would think to ourselves, well, it's the bums on Skid Row, it's these people, it's those people. But you know what? The highest concentration of wickedness is in heavenly places. Remember what Paul told us in Ephesians 6:12? He says, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. What does he mean by the heavenly places? Let me read it again, all right? He says here, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Now, granted, we're dealing with demonic spirits, but where are they most concentrated? They are concentrated in our colleges, in our universities, in our educational system. They're concentrated in our cultural elite, in our entertainment, in our media. In other words, Paul tells us in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, he says, hey, consider your calling, brethren, that there's not many noble among you or wise as far as the world's concerned among you. Most of the people who are Christians are just, you know, they're not higher ups. They're not in places of positions of power. That's not to say that there is none, because there certainly is, but they're always in the minority. I'm just simply saying, I'm looking at who's pulling the strings in this country. All right? It's the people who are in our judicial system, in our government system, the people who have the power. But who's really pulling the strings? It's these forces of wickedness in heavenly places. These people may think that they're calling the shots, but a lot of times they're nothing more than puppets on a string by the powers of darkness. You see what I'm saying? So what Solomon says here, he says in verse 17, I said to myself, verse 16. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in a place of justice there is wickedness. We have seen this so often in so many ways in so many countries. These people were in places of power. It was supposed to be places of justice, but you see this wickedness prevail. But why? Because we're not wrestling against flesh and blood. The reason why there's so much wickedness in heavenly places or high places is because this is where the concentration of demonic forces are. Because they know that, hey, man, let's get a hold of the educational system and we'll really dumb it down and turn these people into complete idiots morally. And that's what's happening. And then he says in that verse, even though he sees this wickedness in places of righteousness, he said in verse 17, I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. So, in other words, even though these people in positions of power feel, they maybe seem like they're getting away literally with murder, well, there's a time of judgment coming for these people. And in verse 18, he says, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast. For all is vanity. For all go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? I have seen that there is nothing better than for man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? And just backing up here, he says, he's looking at, and he said to himself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them so that they could see that they're nothing but beasts. Now, if you read the verse after that, he kind of elaborates or explains where he's coming from. But I think in this verse alone, there's another application, that God tests men to see that they are but beasts. In other words, I run into people all the time. As a matter of fact, I was actually teaching a Bible study Tuesday at St. Peter Paul's Church. where two guys came in, and one was an older man, and I was talking about how, you know, men are basically bad. Men are basically fallen. They're basically evil. They need a savior. They need to change. So on. And he kind of took offense at that because he just said, I'm you know, a good person. And this is what I'm saying about, you know, people just don't see it. I mean, that's the biggest con the devil has on mankind, is to delude them with the fact that you're basically good. When in reality, we are, in God's sight, beast in this respect. When left to our own devices, we will gravitate to that which is evil, because, you know, that's our nature. It's just there. I mean, but people don't see it. By nature, we're selfish and we're self-centered. We're egotistical, we're proud, we're lustful. I've said it 1,000 times. This is what we are by our nature. And we've got to use God's grace to rise above it. As Jesus said, pick up your cross daily and follow me. Remember when Cain killed his brother Abel? All right? It was like God tested him. God tested him to show to him that he was nothing but a beast. In other words, when he was contemplating killing his brother Abel, do you remember what God said to him?
Be careful. You must master the...
He said, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. That's what God told Cain. Sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Well, we all know what happened. He, you know, allowed sin to take control. And he ended up killing his brother Abel. It was the first murder. And what did he kill his brother for? He was jealous of him. He was resentful of him because Abel, you know, found favor in God's sight. Cain could have found favor in God's sight. Why didn't God accept Cain's offering? Cain was a farmer. He brought his vegetables, he brought his fruit, he brought everything else, and he offered up on the altar to sacrifice to God. God did not accept his sacrifice. Abel brought his sheep, cut it up, offered it up on the altar. God accepted it. This is what really ticked Cain off. Well, why didn't God accept Cain's offering?
There was no blood.
Exactly. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And Abel knew that. Why? Because when God first created Adam and Eve, he said they were naked and not ashamed. When they sinned, their eyes were open, they realized they were naked. And then it says that God made for them clothing out of animal skins. Didn't say anything more than that. But you put two and two together. Where do you get animal skins? God just didn't speak them into existence, animal skins. No. Animals had to die so that their sin could be covered. Their shame could be covered. Their guilt could be covered. So, from the very start, God showed them how to be acceptable to him. It was through the shedding of blood. But people try to be acceptable to God in any other way but the way that he has shown. All right? Look at today. The very people who are most hostile to Christians, to people of God, are the ones who feel like they are good. Right? And they've got everything turned on its head, and, you know, Christians are the ones who are intolerant, they're homophobic, they're fanatical, they're this, that, and the other thing, right? Nothing's changed. Thousands of years have come and gone, and you still have the camp of Cain and the camp of Abel. But this is what I'm saying, that God has tested them to show that they are but beasts. And I'm telling you, if you let your sin nature take over, there's almost no limit to the depravity that you will sink. I guarantee it. That's why how many people have shook their head, for example, and looked at some of the most heinous things that people have done. We look at our serial killers. Look at Jeffrey Dahmer. Not only did he sodomize his victims, but he cut them up. He kept their heads and their arms, their legs, their limbs in refrigerators, and he cannibalized off them. He ate them. And we stand back and say, holy criminy, how does a person get to be so, you know, demented? You know, everybody says, well, the guy's insane. I'm telling you what, the guy's possessed. But you can't say that because they slap you around and say, hey, you know, the devil don't exist or you're out of your mind, right? But this is what happens when you give yourself over to two evil. More and more it takes over. And the Bible refers to it as the mystery of iniquity. And when he says this, that men are but beasts, you can take it to the bank. And he says here in that verse 19, he says, for the fate of the sons of men and the fate of the beasts is the same. In other words, under the sun, we're all going to die, animal and man alike. Why? Because we're all under the curse. You know, and it says, and as one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast. It is all vanity. Well, obviously there's an advantage, but he's talking about from the perspective of death. We have no advantages over the animals. They're going to die along with us. We're going to die along with them. And why? This wasn't God's original intent. When God first created man, he gave man dominion over all the animals of the field, over the birds of the air, over the fish of the sea. He gave man dominion over all the creeping things on the face of the earth. Man had dominion over everything. Right? Well, when man fell, he brought all creation down with him. You see, men never ate animals, you know, in God's original design. As a matter of fact, men didn't start eating animals till when?
After the flood.
It was after the Noahian flood. Then God told Noah that he's giving Noah all the animals for his food. In other words, before the Noahian flood, the whole world was totally different. It'd be like stepping on a different planet from what it looks like today. All right, I don't want to go down that road because it's too involved, but I'm just saying that the way the world was constructed, you know, there wasn't even any rain. That's what it tells us in Genesis. It says the mist used to rise from the ground and water everything. And there was this terrarium effect. I mean, there were no polar ice caps. There were no deserts. There were no wastelands. There were none of these things. All right, the whole geography and topography of the world was totally different. As a matter of fact, we get this very distinct impression that there were no continents, that everything was one big landmass, okay, and then there was the ocean surrounding it. But it was only after the Noahian flood that then everything changed. Everything, was different, including our climate, including the sun, including man's lifespan. Everything changed, and God seen that they, because the ground is cursed and because of the judgment of the flood, that man's not going to be able to subsist on fruits and vegetables anymore because everything's changed. So he gave animals for his food. All right. So the animals, unfortunately, they are under the curse because we took them down with us. All right. But in the end, we don't have any advantages over them as far as death is concerned because they're all under the curse. Creation is under the curse. But he goes a little bit further and he says this, verse 20. All go down to the same place, and all came from dust, and all shall return to dust. Well, that's true. But then he says this, who knows that the breath of man, or really the spirit of man, ascends upward, and the spirit of man, or the breath of the beast, ascends downward to the earth. Now, when he asks this question, this is a thing that I think heretics can run off with. Because what he's saying here, it looks like he's saying that there's no consciousness after the grave, or you don't know. I don't want you to turn there, but in the last chapter, chapter 12, he says that in verse 7, he says, the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. So in other words, he knows that man's spirit returns to God. But what he's saying here is that there's no way to prove it. There's no way to prove it. There's no way that we can prove it. With all our scientific technology, there's no way that you can prove that a man's soul leaves his body when he dies. There's a lot of research that's been done to substantiate that, but there's no way you can really prove it. All right? That when you die, your soul departs, your spirit departs from you. But that's what he's saying here. There's no way you can prove that. You have to take that on faith. And anyway, in conclusion, he says this, in verse 22, I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? In other words, hey, you're going to die. All right? And so you might as well enjoy your life while you have it. That's basically what he's boiling down to. He's telling him to live now. Live in the present. Seize the moment. That, to me, is a pretty wise statement. Because we have a tendency to live in the future or live in the past or, you know, get ourselves all worked up about our troubles and our problems. I'm not saying to ignore them. I'm just simply saying that, hey, do your best to enjoy life, what you have left of it, while there's still a chance for it. All right? And simply because you can't have what you want right now, that should be no reason for you, okay, not to seize the moment and enjoy what you have. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?